For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Good evening, everyone. I'm very happy to have Jeremy giving the talk this evening. Jeremy's one of our Doans and our assistant director, and I'm a good Dharma student, so take it away, Jeremy.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming. I wanted to begin by thanking all of you for coming. Everyone in this room has made a huge impact on my practice, definitely, without a doubt. So I wanted to say thank you very much for that. I thought I would talk about how I kind of came to Buddhism, and how my practice started even after I had been sitting for a while. I like to refer to Ancient Dragon Zen Gate as kind of my cold drink of water, and that's in reference to the fire sermon given by the Buddha, where the Buddha reveals the whole world is on fire, and everything on the world is fire, everything around you is on fire, and the Ancient Dragon Zen Gate has been something to cool that fire. I think if I were to categorize, kind of pigeonhole myself and give myself like a type of personality, I would say I have a very type A personality. And I've luckily come here and been able to relax a little bit in that type A personality. I'd say when I've been practicing sitting meditation for about, I think I've come up with my 2-year anniversary. And I was kind of lucky, and I feel almost kind of, not cursed, but I had an interesting start, I'll say. I had these kind of really, what it seemed to me like powerful awakening experiences very, very early in my practice. I had this one experience where I had determined with my all of my effort, you know, whatever, that I was going to sit until I figured it all out. And by the end of it, maybe, you know, I had this kind of what I felt was a realization of emptiness, where when I would pick up a pen, I would see the pen's not a pen. I would say, like, this isn't a pen until I started writing with it. And even then, it's still not a pen. You know, I had this kind of, this insight into the verb of life. And that was great. I can remember another time where I was sitting outside, and it was a beautiful day. I was on break from work, and I worked at this factory that made engines for school buses, and I looked all around me, and I looked at the walls and the pavement, and everything just looked so decrepit, and everything looked like it was falling apart, and I kind of had this moment where it's kind of like staring at the sun, and I had this great experience of oneness with the sun and the universe, and I felt that there's no separation, and I wasn't going to die. I was never really born. I wasn't really going anywhere. I couldn't quite explain it, just this feeling. It's great. But at the same time, I had an ex-girlfriend. Well, I had a girlfriend, but she became my ex-girlfriend. The relationship with her was tense. Very, very tense. I had all these awakening experiences. I had felt like I was starting to crack the code of Buddhism, like I was almost enlightened, right? It's almost there. But I couldn't quite convince myself that that was true, because I had, you know, I had this intimate relationship that was not so intimate in a lot of areas. I had a lot of separation between myself and this person. I remember, for example, this time I was sitting on her bed. I'd just driven to see her, and I sat her down. I was like, you know, we have to have this conversation. I've been doing this sitting practice, and I've had all these experiences, and I have to figure it out. I have to do whatever I have to do to figure out this mystery. I have to solve it. If I have to leave you and I have to go to a monastery, I'll do it. If I have to, anything, you name it, just drop it all, give it all up, that's it. And I didn't realize at that point how much of an ass I really was. It was like being a fireman in front of a burning house and being like, I'm not going to turn the hose on. I'm just going to sit here and watch this burning that's going on in front of me that I'm kind of causing or being a part of, and I'm not going to help. I was too kind of stuck in myself to see this person outside of me as someone who might need help or might actually need a mate. I guess that's partly to do, this person I was talking about that was very ambitious, but I also, the kind of Dharma I was reading and listening to was also this Dharma that was saying things like kill ego and kill self. And if you see Buddha outside of you, kill Buddha outside of you. Like, there's only Buddha within. And while the intention of what is being said is true, looking back on it, I agree with what those things, the intention of what was being said. But as a beginning practitioner, I didn't see that. I didn't see the wisdom in it. So I put a lot of effort into killing self, into killing ego. And so whenever my ex-girlfriend would talk about how she was feeling sick someday, or she was feeling detached from me because I was purposely detaching myself from the situation, I was unable to meet her. Quite frankly, because I was too busy killing self. And I was too busy trying to kill ego. And I couldn't do both at the same time. I couldn't be intimate with her, and I couldn't put forth this great effort to kill whatever I thought I was supposed to kill, destroy it. And I wanted to cite a misconception I had. By citing the most popular part of Genjo Koan, seems to me the most popular part. It starts off with, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by a myriad things. And I'm going to stop it right there. There's a little bit more after that. I feel like my attitude beginning practice was to skip the part of to study the Buddha ways to study the self and get right to the forgetting the self, right? Because that's the problem, right? The self is the problem. I have to kill the self. So why study the self when I can just skip right to the good part of forgetting self? Why not? Sounded like a good idea at the time. So I'll stop there with that, and I wanted to cite something in Dogen's extensive record. The particular discourse, I believe, it's number 8, Dharma Hall discourse. Its title is A Plum's Ripening, and it goes a little bit like this. Here's a story, Mazu said. This mind itself is Buddha. Daimei, great plum, studied this more than 30 years, dwelling on his mountaintop, hiding his traces in the sounds of the valley and the colors of the mountain. The ancestor Mazu finally sent a monk to visit and say to Daimei, Mazu's Buddha Dharma is different these days. Daimei responded, how is it different? The monk said, no mind, no Buddha. Daimei said, even if he says no mind, no Buddha, I just follow, this mind itself is Buddha. The monk returned and told the ancestor. Mazu said, that plum is ripe. Dogen's commentary, Dogen said, this mind itself is Buddha is most intimate. Year after year, Daimei ripened in the middle of summer. I feel like this particular Dharma discourse I feel like it's it mirrors what I think of as what I've been coming to realize after some 2 years of practice. This question I've had of what is Buddha? What is big B Buddha, and what is little B Buddha? And is there really any difference? The passage says this mind itself is Buddha, but I've sat zazen sometimes in this very hall and had thoughts of murdering everybody with a knife. This mind itself is Buddha. Is that Buddha? Who knows? Is it feeling discouraged after a day of teaching high school age children and feeling you want to quit it forever and never come back? And then having to deal with maybe perhaps breaking the hearts of the children who actually enjoy your company there? You know, what is it? I feel like when I hear this mind itself as Buddha and I conceptualize my own idea of what mind is, I have this word that I like to call it. I call it the heart of separation. Some people say it's ego. Some people have other words of whatever it is, but I feel like it's the part of us that is helpful at keeping us from stepping in front of buses, but it's also the part that constantly can say, Taigen's sitting next to me, and Buddha's over there, and I'll always be single, and I'll never be able to move on, and I'll never make anything of my life, and I really want an iPad 3, and that kind of stuff, right? And earlier in my practice, I thought it was my job to kill those thoughts, and I didn't see any value in it at all. No value whatsoever. But the passage is saying this mind itself is Buddha. And I'm on this path of the Bodhisattva. And I feel like part of being on the path of the Bodhisattva is to, in a certain way, realize Buddha for what it is. Realize this mystery, realize who this being is, how this being relates to others. And so I can't ignore this wisdom that's been passed down that says this mind itself is Buddha. This mind that conjures up separation itself is Buddha. And it sets up somewhat of a kind of a funny paradox where if we say that Buddha is all things, even the thing that creates separation, that itself is Buddha. The very thing that says that it's all separate and reminds me that it's all separate is in itself that which is all things and is a part of all things. And itself is not separate. And I feel like over the course of practicing with this idea of this mind itself as Buddha, I started to do some funny things. When I would come home on a Friday night, I would make prostrations to a bed that was empty. I was only going to have one person sleeping in it because I felt like at that moment that was the truth of that situation that I was unable to cope with. These thoughts of the social pressure of finding someone to sleep with and getting married and having children. And I felt like the only way I could possibly handle that situation is to give up completely to that situation, completely give up to the mind that was creating that situation. And in that, completely giving up to Buddha at the very same time. And the same goes for the meal that I would eat by myself, the single-served meal for one, which was also a constant reminder to myself that that this is the truth, this is what's happening, and no matter what mind says, that this is, you know, this is a commentary on the rest of my life, that I need to be completely present with this situation I'm also trying to get away from. That's totally true, that I will be eating this meal by myself, and that this mind is telling me that is going to be that way forever, right? The delusion is not separate from mind that's creating it, which is not separate from Buddha. Also, something that's happened is now that I can kind of come to situations with a little bit of attention, that I shouldn't be running away from these thoughts and these feelings, that this itself is Buddha, this itself is the lesson, this is the teacher. You know, when I'm irritated, I can tell people that I'm irritated. When I'm feeling tired, I can tell people that I'm feeling tired and that I have to withdraw for a little bit. I have to take care of myself. Without this intimacy with this mind, there is no concept of limitation, I guess. There's no actually paying attention to it. At least that's the way it's been for me. So I think I'd like to go back to the passage. Drink some water. There's seemingly two parts to this Dharma Hall discourse. There's the part where Mazu said that this mind itself is Buddha, and Daime practices that. And then there's this part where the monk comes back and says that it's all different now, and that no mind, no Buddha is now what Mazu teaches. And I feel like this no mind, no Buddha is very close to what I kind of started with. I started practicing with this idea of find a way to get self out of the way, or as Dogen would say, to forget self, to some way of letting self go. And I don't feel like the two teachings are different. I feel like this mind itself is Buddha, and no mind, no Buddha lead to the same place. I feel like when one is intimate with this mind and this Buddha, that is the path of forgetting self. It's studying self. As Dogen says, after you study self, you forget self. And be actualized by myriad things. So I feel like these two approaches are somewhat the same. And it just, I guess it comes with some experience. Let's see what I'm doing for time. Not so good. I think that's all I have to say. I apologize.
That was fine. Thank you for really sincerely sharing yourself and your practice. Does anyone have comments or responses for Jeremy or for the rest of us about any of this?
And I, you know what, there's actually, I'm sorry, there's one more thing that I wanted to quick say.
Go ahead.
I wanted to make sure that, talking about, as I've come to realize over the past couple years, talking about the Dharma is so can be so tricky. And I don't want to put forth this idea that, yes, this mind is Buddha, but there's also time to not listen to thoughts, especially during Zazen. There's some time to kind of use Manjushri's sword and cut through delusion and say, no, you know, cut the tie off. And, I didn't want to make it sound like I was saying, you know, whatever goes on in mind is okay. Sometimes there's that time to stop thought. But.
So, yeah, this koan you're bringing us and that you're expressing through your own experience or practice very sincerely is, you know, very deep. This very mind is Buddha, and yet no mind, no Buddha. How do we find our way of expressing this, both sides of that? So this is very deep. Thank you for bringing it to us. Again, any comments or responses, please feel free. Yes, Paul.
I guess I struggle with that line to study the self is to forget the self. But I guess the way that I can maybe approach it is in the sense that it's sort of like a musician who has now mastered the instrument, let's say mastered in his gap beyond all the technical. I'll take a calorie, so I'll take a shrimp, and I can just throw down, I guess in jazz, like, you know, you can just throw down chords or what may sound like noise to a lot of people, but the instrumentalist has actually come a long way to be able to do that, or there's probably 1,000 different examples in our world. But is that sort of the idea is that you've studied the self to a point where you've kind of got over a hill or a hurdle and you now overcome it somehow?
Answer that? Okay, sorry.
I'll respond as well, but okay, why don't you go ahead first?
Okay, thanks. I had a package delivered to my house today. Well, I thought it was going to be delivered to my house, and it wasn't there when I got there. And I checked the tracking shipment thing, and the computer had told me that it was there. And my conclusion was that someone stole it, and I got really mad. I would say that that's... no, there's no hill I've gotten over. I mean, I'm definitely all... it's a lifelong practice. Studying self is a lifelong practice. And self, kind of what I was kept trying to get at is that, and I didn't fully get to, was this idea of self is not something to be killed. Like it is in my the way I think of it, it is a beating heart. It's a cry to be listened to. It's the very song of Buddha. You know, it's this kind of. Truth in itself, and I would say that that your comment about the musical instrument, I would say no matter what song you make with an instrument or what you're doing with it, there's always an opportunity to study self, no matter what profession or how good you are at it. Always an opportunity.
Yeah, well said. I just add that I agree. It's not that we study self and then we don't study self anymore and just forget self. There's studying self is endless. One way to see what Dogen is saying is that studying the self in itself is forgetting the self. That when we're really thoroughly seeing our own responses and willing to own that and willing to face ourself, that is letting go of our grasping of self. That is letting go of self. I think your musical example, though, is very good, that as we do that studying the self, Yeah, as we learn technique, as you put it, there's a kind of freedom then that we can express that in new ways. And so non-self, this idea of studying the self and forgetting the self has to do with this basic Buddhist teaching of non-self. And non-self does not mean killing ego or getting rid of the ego. It means seeing, I talked about this a little bit yesterday, seeing that this small, that our idea of the self is actually connected with everything. And we're not grasping on to this little self anymore, but it's an endless process, and we keep stumbling across, you know, all of our ideas that our packages have been stolen, you know. So this is a really central issue. Other reflections, please. Nyo-san.
What you said, you mentioned letting go, and I don't know if I was talking about it here or maybe at Rockefeller Chapel, but thinking about this particular passage that you brought up and other things, I got curious about the word to forget. So I looked it up, as is my habit, and checked out the Indo-European root of the word. And one of the core sort of senses of it is precisely to let go of something. You know, and, you know, it's possible to let go of something without it going anywhere. You know, what's different is a certain kind of grippiness, a certain kind of manipulation and control is not any longer the same. You know, if you're not forgetting it, you are forgetting it, but it doesn't necessarily have the sense that something has to become lost to you.
Good. Yeah, and I think forget also relates to forego, to let go. In a way, there's some place where Dogen talks about generosity in terms of forgetting. To forget yourself is being generous, is giving of yourself. So there's a complex of meanings there. Yes, Josh.
Thank you for your talk, Tim.
Thank you.
This reminded me, when you were talking about the beginning of your talk, reminded me one of my teachers was Phil Kaplan-Rishi, and I feel like he was very into no mind and pretty harsh about it. He studied with Harada Rishi, who used to beat people to a pulp with a stick and used to parade people around and said, at the end of sessions, he would parade people around and say, this person got Kensho. So this is what Kaplow came from, and yet he brought so much to American Zen, and I really respect him. But I sat at a session right after he died where it was a really cool release for me, because all of the teachings were recorded teachings from Philip Kaplow. And he has this really cool, gravelly, Zen master-like voice. And I really got into this kind of like Zen warrior thing where I was staying up all night and then at the end, my teacher gave it the last day and I gave it a teacher, and it basically talked about how he had come to know the flaws in his teacher, and it was a neat release for me because I had gotten into that, like. So it's really kind of interesting. I do think that energy is useful. I do think it can help practice, but it needs to be, I guess, balanced. And then one other thing that reminded me, Eiken Roshi used to say, I've seen strange creatures grow in Zendo. And he was talking about this kind of like almost dark cloud that can come over.
Laurel, thank you, Josh. Laurel, having practiced in a little bit in some of those lineages, do you have any thoughts about you know what Josh was saying or what Jeremy was saying?
Well, so many things I could say. I would start by saying my favorite thing about the Sangha is that people in the Sangha give talks because we sit in a room facing the wall in silence and we think we know what's going on in the room, and then people come and tell you their story. It's just so powerful and intimate and valuable. So thank you for having that be part of what we did in the Sangha. Yes, I spent many years in the Sangha getting hit with a stick and being berated for not being able to stay up all night, which I'm just very bad at. And being yelled at for twitching. And it gave me very good discipline, which I still value. I can really control myself in difficult situations. It's a skill that I really appreciate. I'm not sure it was worth the experience to get there. I think it's sort of like I have a nephew that was a Marine, and we talked about that one time, how that was, and the good of it and the not so good of it. But the freedom from the liberation from the expectation of getting to Kensho is just the healthiest thing I can think of in changing my practice. That just was just not helpful. That was just plugged into my worst type A achievement, good girl, personality stuff that not helpful, not helping me grow and be a more fully expressed person. But it's interesting.
Thank you, Laurel.
Thanks for bringing it up.
I think this does have to do with this, you know, really important couple of stories that relate to Mazu that Jeremy brought up. And again, I appreciate, Jeremy, that you know, speaking so honestly about your own struggles and your own sense of loneliness. And, you know, we all have that. That's an experience. But this very mind is Buddha. No mind, no Buddha. You know, Dame said, I don't care about no mind, no Buddha. This very mind is Buddha for me. But really we have to face both sides of that. So there's the cutting through, which can be very useful. And yet we have to study the self and be honest about ourselves and see and be willing to face all the stuff. This is a challenging practice. Whether the challenge is, you got to get Kensho, or whether the challenge is, okay, just sit. You know, be present. What's it like? How are you? How does it feel? You know, I like the gentle side more too, but I did have some experience of that more Rinzai style pushy practice early on in my practice, and I, you know, it was valuable for me too. Other thoughts, anyone? Dawn.
Thanks for your talk. So, I did like, though, when you were talking about your personal experiences, like the bed, and I don't know if you did prostrations to your food too. But no, like, I think that that's really cool. Like, you had, like, you were, like, trying to find something that worked from your practice that you had learned. And I, I think that that's when it's important. So, you've been coming here, you know, and you've been practicing and with whatever you're working with and whatever you're practicing with, and then taking it, using it in your practical out in the world. And like, that's totally, like, I think that's a really cool way to, you know, why not do prostrations to the bed, you know, to make that work. And I don't know, I think that that's really cool to kind of think about what's going to work. I don't know. So I just thought that was really cool. And I mean, there's lots of things that I've done that are kind of, you know, different, you know, that would be, you know, that from the practice, because I think that it's very helpful. And I don't think that there are any rules saying that I can't do those things. And so, but that's what helps me and helps the situation right then. And so that's what's worked. And so that's been really important to me, to have those tools, because I wouldn't have had those before. I just would have been a big heaping mess, on the floor. And so now I have, these tools, you know, that I've learned here. And so I think that's really cool. So I'm glad that you shared that, you know. So thanks.
Yeah, this is kind of funny. I mean, I almost, I prostrate to Taigen, too, when I go into the Dokusan room. I can say that Taigen's my teacher, but I almost don't want to call Taigen my teacher. I'd rather refer to him as, a spiritual friend, because...
That's one definition of teacher.
Yeah, well, I mean, but I feel like, you know, the intention that you have is, for my practice, is somewhat better than my own at times. And I feel like there's just, a difference, almost, in naming it for those two things. But, I mean, I think my intention of prostrating myself to anything is to kind of actualize this idea of that everything is your teacher. Everything is a Dharma gate, constantly being approached by Dharma gates. If you could have, you know, the perfect situation, like a pocket Taigen or a pocket Shakyamuni Buddha or someone just to remind you constantly, you know, that this is the lesson. You know, what better teacher than this mind? You know, what better teacher than the very thing that points out all the problems that you have with everything else, you know?
So. That's really cool. Thanks.
I think everyone here has some mix of practice experiences. Not so many people, actually, of the people who come regularly to Ancient Dragon Zen Gate began practicing here. And I think that's a kind of richness of our Sangha as well. It occurred to me, Ken, I know you have a mix of practice backgrounds. I just wondered if you had any reflections on... Ken, if you had any reflections on any of this.
On practice? Yeah,
anything we've been talking about. This mind is Buddha, or forgetting the self, or whatever.
Well, it's nice to hear, you know, Jeremy share his personal practice and everything, and the I think gives perspective to everybody in terms of their own practice. And I think I would have a question in terms of your specific techniques. I mean, do you Shikantaza as a main practice, or you know, follow the breath, this kind of thing, or do you pretty much focus on more of a koan type of approach in terms of the you know, your personal approach?
I didn't actually, you know, it's funny, I actually never thought I had a personal approach.
Whatever it happens to you,
right? No, I think anything that's really kind of rattled and shook up my practice has happened off my cushion. And I mean, I'm a full-time teacher now, and it's been an incredible experience for me, because I'm constantly bombarded with these situations where, like, I can feel the adrenaline pumping through me, and I have to find a way to relax, or else all hell's going to break through, you know. And, you know, I am in situations with colleagues where there's, like, years of baggage that now I'm put into, and I have to find some way to be, you know, work with everyone, because, I mean, I have this deep knowing that we're not separate. I felt it. And I'm not going to work in a workplace and operate on a basis of separation. And so I have to work with that constantly.
So you're sort of inspired in dealing with the myriad things that arise to deal with. And did you work as an elementary school teacher or college? Or?
High school.
High school. Oh, you know,
yeah. No, Jeremy has a very challenging job. He's really taken it on. And I'm very happy that we have numbers of teachers in our Sangha. It's, education is sort of under threat as a vehicle in our society, and I really appreciate teachers of all kinds. And you know, it's time to end up. But you know, I think Ken's question and your response goes back to Genjo Koan, and that one aspect of our practice is to sit with whatever it is that's moving through us, you know, this week, you know, this evening, the stuff of our life, and to face that. So I think what Jeremy has presented is his engagement with that. So thank you very much, Jeremy.